I'm Andy Worthington. I'm an independent journalist. I've been writing for over 20 years. And my interest in the Battle of the Beanfield, which, of course, was 40 years ago, really began at the time that it happened. I was a student, and I got to go to the Stonehenge Free Festival in 1983 and in 1984, so suddenly my eyes were open to this alternative, massive alternative community that existed. And then, of course, in 1984, the Thatcher government issued an injunction against the convoy travelling to Stonehenge to try and set up what would have been the 12th festival. And then savagely decommissioned them at what has become known as the Battle of the Beanfield on June the 1st, 1985. What I did in the early 2000s was to research and write a social history of Stonehenge, a kind of countercultural history of Stonehenge called Stonehenge Celebration and Subversion, which looked at the kind of Druids and the pagan history of Stonehenge, and then also its modern countercultural history. I've been a very big part of that, of course, was the Battle of the Beanfield, you know, which led to a 15-year military exclusion zone around Stonehenge every summer solstice.
Yeah, well, this was in the middle of the Thatcher government as well, where there was things like the miners' strike, Wapping, all this going on, basically a shutdown of much of traditional culture, particularly, I mean, looking at the newspapers, it's had a massive effect. The idea of the sort of trust between the journalist unions, the printing unions, being a sort of bulwark against owners and editors trying to shape the news. And also, look, I mean, I don't know if you could, because so much of this Beanfield and the festival culture, we now really see through pictures and photos. But can you just give us an idea of what those Stonehenge free festivals you went to? What was it like spending a few days there? What was going on?
Well, I would say the interesting thing about it, Tony, is that it was a slightly scruffier and probably slightly more druggy version of the Glastonbury festivals. The two things are quite closely related. And, you know, although Glastonbury was, you know, is on the grounds of Michael Eavis, who was once memorably described as a Somerset farmer with crowd-gathering tendencies. The same people, inspired by, you know, what people at the time were seeing from the U.S. counterculture and from the festival scene over there, who were establishing festivals in the U.K., were working on a very kind of communal anti-materialistic basis. And so, you know, that's what it was like, really. It was that there wasn't that much difference between the Glastonbury festivals and the Stonehenge festivals at that time. But the Stonehenge festivals were completely unlicensed, and they were, you know, in proximity to Britain's greatest ancient monument. And as a result of that, they became the target for the Thatcher government. And it's important, I think, to remember, Tony, that Thatcher did explicitly refer to both the miners and the travellers as enemies within.
Yeah, amazing, really. So what about facilities at a free festival? Because this is just a whole bunch of people coming together. When people do get together like that, you've got to have basic things. You've got to have sanitation. You've got to have fresh water has got to be available. You've got to have potentially, you know, things like showers. People are going to be there for a week or more. You've also got to have decent food facilities. So there are certain aspects of everyone getting together which does need to be organised. But this was a spontaneous event.
Well, it was a you know, kind of fundamentally leaderless event, I think. But I mean, the basis of it was the travellers, and they lived in vehicles, you know, were travelling around the country from free festival to free festival, really from May till September. So these were very self-sufficient people who knew how to you know, run their lives off grid, and who also, you know, knew how to look after sites, so that, you know, the whole, that there was an ethos in those early days of the festivals of, you know, leaving no trace. Obviously, it starts to become logistically rather complicated when you're getting thousands or tens of thousands of day trippers or of people who don't really know what they're doing. But I think the important thing always to remember about Stonehenge was that it didn't really cause very much damage to the landscape, and it also had considerably less crime than you would get in a similar sized town over a weekend. Take a market town, fuel the people up with alcohol, and see how much more damage was done there than was done at the Stonehenge Free Festival.
People would argue there's actually lots of a class A drug taking, which wouldn't happen in a normal town.
It wouldn't happen in a normal town, but I mean, we're going back to the 70s and the 80s, when when there probably was more drug taking that was happening. But also, you know, let's take a cue from the Dutch police, shall we? That they've always said, the problem, isn't cannabis. The problem is alcohol. I think we're going back to a time where the vibe was much, was kind of much more pleasant. I think drugs have, in general, become harder. And, you know, I don't want to gloss over the fact that there were issues, Tony. If we were to look at the counterculture and a drug history, what we would find is that there were two particular blights, and always have been, on all kinds of alternative movements. One of those, obviously, is heroin. The other one is cocaine. And, they have a very different social impact. But, I do remember hearing stories about one point when there was an influx of cocaine into Stonehenge, which was just devastating, because cocaine is the most horrible, antisocial, ego-boosting, idiotic drug. It's the one that people in power use, and it's not really something that's conducive to what was supposed to be happening in the Traveller and Free Festival circuit.
Well, I mean, if I can chip in, that was also used here in Bristol, in St. Paul's, where I'm speaking to you from, to completely disrupt the anti-apartheid movement in the 1980s by injecting coke and crack cocaine into the community here. So it's a social disruptive, isn't it?
Yeah. And actually, it's a good point to make, Tony, that we don't know how much of this was deliberate. Because certainly, as we know from the spy cops saga that's going on at the moment, the government, government agents directly intervened to try and destroy any movement that looked like it was causing opposition to the government.
Yeah, so on the wider picture, before we get into the Battle of Bingfield itself, what we witnessed over the decades since the beginning of the Stonehenge Festival and Glastonbury is a sort of corralling. So the idea is, let's let people do this almost just about all on their own, licensed or unlicensed. It's going to be very little controls, no particular ring of steel around it.
Really,
but that's now, that's been sort of corralled, it seems to me. So the idea is, you put a big reel of steel about it, you privatize it, which of course was the great theme of the 1980s, and so what's changed if you look at this now?
Well, everything changed. I mean, I remember when the rings of steel started to come in, because, this is probably 20 years ago, so it would be when the book came out. The Battle of the Beanfield book came out in 2005 as a spin-off from my Stonehenge book. And I remember talking to Tash, the great festival photographer, about Nottingham, because Nottingham had an annual free festival that took place at the end of summer. And suddenly the annual free festival has stopped being what it had, and the Ring of Steel went up. It completely changes our relationship to what's happening when a festival is fenced off and privatized and it becomes about corporate money. I mean, you can't exaggerate what a difference it is when something is open and everybody is allowed to be there. Nobody is making money from it. You know, in the situation that we're in now, Tony, where I think increasingly year on year, the ability to take part in any of these things is, you know, the number of people who can do it is reduced year on year, because there are so many people who genuinely are struggling to make ends meet from week to week, and certainly don't have hundreds of pounds to spend on going and standing inside a fortress for a day and watching popular musicians.
Here in Bristol, I'm just thinking about the Ashton Court Festival, which around about 2008, I think it was, roughly, was just cancelled 1 year and then never happened again. That was a free festival that took place annually, supported by the City Council. I mean, there are countless examples, actually, of these sorts of events. I mean, even if you go back to the Victorian era, the Forest Fair in Oxfordshire at Wychwood Forest, which took place after St Giles Festival in Oxford every year up until about, I think it was sometime in the 1880s, that had been going since medieval times. and suddenly they just decided 1 year to stop the fair. And ever since, that whole area has been private. There aren't footpaths through it. There are only footpaths around the edges of the forest. And so this is, again, it's about privatisation. It seems to me that the whole...
Well, it absolutely is, Tony, because when I came to London in 1985, and at that point, the TUC used to have a free May Day concert on Clapham Common. And, of course, the GLC was in power. And actually, Ken Livingstone and the GLC put on free events across London, massive free events, you know, throughout that period. And everything was then, you know, I mean, Thatcher hated the GLC so much that she, you know, got rid of it. So Britain became the only country whose capital city didn't actually have a government for 14 years until it was reintroduced back in 2000. You know, she was controlling the City of London from the Houses of Parliament. It's quite extraordinary. But it was all part of a process of dispossessing us from anything where things could be provided, you know, for free, that were accessible to everyone. And that, of course, you know, is tied in with the money-making side of it. So it's not only that you shut off things that are done on a not-for-profit basis, it's that you actually massively amplify the for-profit basis of the people that are involved in it. And we now have this, you know, kind of absurd situation where Glastonbury, which was partly founded by anti-materialistic, politicized hippies in the early 1970s, has now become this bloated corporate city that arises once a year that has pretty much bears no resemblance to what it was when it was founded. And it's kind of a metaphor for what has happened as greed has got more and more out of control.
Well, yes, right. And also, it's almost like the whole moral compass of society has changed. And these are just simply stations on the road. The purpose of getting together for a free festival is to hear music, to have fun, to relax. The purpose of an event like the Modern Glastonbury Festival is to make money.
Yeah.
So you get, you know, various decisions are being made about the shape of it based on profit and what will make money and what won't. And this, I suppose, is almost translating to people's own lives. Like, you know, where do I want to live? Who do I want to marry? All sorts of the decisions that we make now seem to be motivated not by either what we want to do or what we feel is good for us, by what we think is morally right, but it's just finance seems to have eaten into almost everything, Andy.
Yeah, I think it's the commodification of almost everything, Tony, isn't it? You know, there are very few areas of our existence that are left where we can exercise control and autonomy over our lives outside of a prevailing economic system.
Anyway, look, let's get to your book and let's get to the battle itself. Can you just take us through what happened that day? You've already explained that this was a long-running injunction. So If any travellers were paying close attention on the peace convoy, they would have known that there could possibly be trouble, because there's an injunction had been, as I understand it, had been quite long-standing for them prohibiting them from Stonehenge.
I think the best perspective on it briefly is to start with the summer of 1984. So that's the year of the miners' strike. And, you know, the most famously violent confrontation between the police and the miners was at Orgreave in South Yorkshire in June 1984. Now, a month after that, in West Yorkshire, a place called Nostell Priory, where a festival was taking place, a group of travellers who were there as part of the peace convoy were savagely attacked by the police. They had their homes destroyed. People were arrested. And they were then forcibly kind of escorted down south. Many of those people ended up at Molesworth. Molesworth was an RAF base, and it was the intended second base for US-controlled cruise missiles after Greenham Common, where, of course, you know, there was the famous women's peace camp established in 1981. So there was a protest camp that was set up at Molesworth. And this, in February 1985, this was violently decommissioned by, extraordinary, really, over 1,000 soldiers, nominally led by the defense minister, Michael Heseltine. And the members of the convoy who were there were then harried around the south of England for the next 3 to 4 months, until, you know, they ended up in Savernake Forest in Wiltshire, preparing the next day to make their way to Stonehenge, where this long-standing injunction had been put in place. So the bigger picture is really, it ties the miners and the travellers much closer together. If you think that the same paramilitarized police who were beating the crap out of miners at Orgreave, some of those would be the same people that a month later did the same thing to the travellers. And this whole thing unfolded throughout the whole of the year. So when it came to June the 1st, the convoy of around 140 vehicles that set off for Stonehenge encountered a roadblock. The people at the front of the convoy were notified because the motorbike outrider on the day was Dale Vince, who is now the owner of Ecotricity. And I think that's a good little example of how we weren't looking at really looking at disruptive anarchists when we see the way that the media reported what was happening with the convoy. The convoy had quite a strong environmental thrust. And I think we can kind of see that from what's happened to Dale Vince in his life since. But anyway, so the convoy is backed up because of this roadblock. The police then start coming along vehicle after vehicle, smashing the windows, dragging people out through broken windows. I mean, we're talking about men, women, and children here. And then part of the convoy worked out that the only way out of this was to break through into a neighboring field. And then there was a kind of field system there, and one of them was beans were growing, hence the name the Bean Field. So there was a standoff in the afternoon. Things were extremely tense. And it was clear that, you know, the police required everyone to surrender. Everyone would be arrested. And when people resisted this, you know, having spent all day saying, look, just let us go. We won't go anywhere near Stonehenge. We will be out of here. No problem. At the late afternoon, early evening, then these 1,400 tooled up paramilitarized police invaded the field and just started beating the crap out of everyone. And that would have been unknown, really, Tony, had it not been for the fact that there was an ITN News film crew that was in the field. And there was also Nick Davis and a photographer from The Observer. And to some extent, they managed to report what happened. Nick Davis wrote about it for The Observer quite forcefully, about the terrible injustices of the day. Kim Savido of ITN News discovered that it destroyed his career, but also discovered that almost everything that him and his film crew had filmed disappeared, and a sanitized version of events was broadcast on the news. they almost managed to keep everything hidden, but not entirely. But of course, the, you know, the tabloid media had been on side and had been briefed on this for ages, you know, putting out ridiculous headlines about, you know, about how these were like dangerous, tooled up anarchists trying to destroy the country. And on the day, of course, all of the representatives of the mainstream media obeyed the police orders and refused to go anywhere near what was happening.
Well, I know some did, and it was it was reported in some places on our very own GWR radio here in Bristol. The commercial station definitely reported on it, at least reasonably accurately, saying that what the police seemed to have done was what. What was the idea? Was everyone arrested? Did the police actually have a system for arresting people, detaining people, putting them in Black Mariah's and shipping them off to somewhere, Amesbury or somewhere nearby?
Yeah, they did, sadly. They arrested everyone. They dispersed them to all kinds of cells and holding centres across the southeast. You know, one group of travellers were held for about 7 hours in some garages behind buildings somewhere. They set fire to and destroyed the vehicles. They put down a number of the travellers' dogs. And I think most horribly, they took all the kids into care. Some of that took quite some time to get families reunited. So, yeah, it was absolutely systematic destruction. Absolutely everybody was brutalized on that day.
And so was there any activity whatsoever at Stonehenge? Because the idea, I mean, surely the travelers must have known they were up against it with this injunction in place. They must have been expecting trouble.
Yeah, I mean, I think they just thought, look, we have to go for it. What's going to happen is that either they'll say, no, you're absolutely not coming this year, and they'll turn us away, and we will reluctantly have to accept that, you know, they've secured their aim, which is to shut down the fields around Stonehenge from us having a free festival. I think it was reasonable. It depends where you come down on it, Tony. It was naive to an extent of people, but I don't think anyone should necessarily have presumed that the violence that was meted out was going to be delivered to them. I would have said if they had been paying close attention to what happened at Orgreave and the way that the police had been paramilitarized by Thatcher, that it was a reasonable assumption that they were going to do something extraordinary.
What about the details of the injunction? What, was there any indication of, say, for example, a line on the A303 that if they crossed it, the police were likely to intervene because the injunction?
I think there was a distance, but I mean, the whole thing was pretty much, you know, cobbled together as an attempt to block them. I mean, I don't think they knew many, if any, of the people that were involved. So their blanket injunction was really, I think, legally was extremely vague. But, you know, it was the device that they used to justify, you know, everything that they did. And once they'd done it, of course, then it became a question of how do you seek redress for something that that they've more or less managed to get away with without any blame being attached for them and how they behaved. And, you know, all that there has ever been in terms of holding them to account is that a number of the travellers took them to court for wrongful arrest and brutality in 1991. And in a kind of unfortunately mixed verdict, secured some blame against the police, but didn't get any compensation themselves for it. The judge arranged for all of those costs to be swallowed up in the legal costs of the day. But, you know, as with Orgreave, Tony, there's never been an official inquiry into what happened in that period. So what can we say? Thatcher kind of got away with it in a way,
yeah,
didn't she?
Yeah, she certainly did. What about more recent events at the site of Stonehenge?
Well, I mean, what happened after the... So there really was a military exclusion zone around Stonehenge. Every summer solstice. It sounds ridiculous to hear it now, but I mean, I remember seeing footage years ago, just really shocking footage. This was in the early 90s. There's a Japanese couple of tourists, and they're walking down the access path to Stonehenge, having parked up in the car park. And as they're walking down the access path, a long-haired hippie troublemaker is trying to get over the fence to get access to Stonehenge. And he has the crap beaten out of him by the police right in front of this couple of Japanese tourists. You know, this happened every year. The full account of what happened year on year as, you know, as some of the travelers and then, you know, also some of the druids who had been using Stonehenge at the solstice, all of the various confrontations and negotiations and all of the things that happened. It's an interesting story, but legally the most significant component is that eventually the exclusion zone was ruled illegal by the lawlords in 1999. And that was after a number of protesters who had been protesting peacefully on the verge of the road were arrested and charged. And they managed to take their case all the way up to the law lords, now the Supreme Court, to say, you know, we were just trying to make our voices heard. We weren't being disruptive. We didn't stop traffic. And the law lord said, yes, actually, when you feel that you have been wronged and there's no redress for your activities, you are allowed to protest peacefully on the side of a road. The government has no right to stop you from doing that, so long as it doesn't involve violence. If you cross the line into violence, yes, you can be arrested and punished for it. But if you are non-violent, like the protesters were, that they had no right to do it. And the exclusion zone then suddenly didn't exist anymore. And ironically, English Heritage and the National Trust were forced into a position where they had to reopen Stonehenge on the summer solstice to visitors under what they have called managed open access, very unromantic term for it. And it means that, you know, every summer solstice from dusk until dawn, there's a kind of party that takes place at Stonehenge for tens of thousands of people, some of whom are certainly there for, you know, for reverent reasons, but others who are just out for a party, which is ironic compared to the Stonehenge Free Festival, because most people didn't go to the stones from the festival. It was only the people who were specifically interested in its spiritual component.
What do you think has changed in society now as a result of all this? You know, 40 years ago, this attack by Thatcher on the peace convoy and on the Free Festival, Andy, because we've now got many more people, certainly here in Bristol, living in caravans and vehicles. Certainly not by choice. Most of the people, it's just simply because they cannot afford the extremely high costs of renting accommodation now. And also, of course, we've got this cost of living crisis, which is all to do with gas and electricity bills, water bills. A lot of this does seem to lead back to Thatcher.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, I mean, what I think is a crucial lesson to be learned from the Beanfield and what happened afterwards is that the government introduced draconian laws designed to prevent the movement of travellers and to prevent our ability to gather freely as a result of the Beanfield. And then they did the same again in the 1990s when, you know, I mean, it's quite hilarious looking back. Thatcher must have thought that she'd won, and then suddenly ecstasy turned up, and then millions of people were going out raving in the countryside. That led to the last huge unlicensed gathering in modern British history, which was in the May Bank Holiday in 1992 at Castle Morton Common in Gloucestershire, when about 50,000 people got together. And after that, they then introduced, again, more repressive legislation that was designed to make trespass illegal,
Oh, this, that's right. This is the Criminal Justice Act. Criminal Justice Act.
Criminal Justice Act.
Yeah, criminal trespass law.
I mean, they came up with trespassory assembly in that, which meant that, you know, 20 people gathered together without permission could be arrested. You've gone from somewhere where 50,000 people managed to gather without being arrested because of a kind of quaint notion that, you know, because we don't have a written constitution, there's a gray area as to what we're allowed to do and what we're not allowed to do. And then suddenly you know, you've got this clampdown where, you know, ever since then, the police can arrest 20 people who can't provide them with a good justification for why they should be allowed to gather. And we've seen, I would say what's particularly important, Tony, is realizing that draconian laws are almost never repealed. So what's happened over the 40 years from the Beanfield is that we have become more and more authoritarian as a country. And let's look at, in particular, at the latest phase of that, which is the anti-protest laws of Priti Patel and Suella Braverman. It's a cumulative effect, and it becomes more and more draconian, more and more authoritarian. And these laws are never repealed, which leaves us in a position where we now have almost no right to do anything freely that they don't want us to do without having secured permission that we might not be allowed to get in the first place. And, you know, and I think that's a dreadful position to be in. As for what you're talking about how more and more people are now living in vehicles and in all kinds of alternative ways of living, brought about by the horrendous housing bubble that we've had for the last 25 years, where it's literally unaffordable for so many people to live and pay rent under any circumstances, and, you know, and the hugely inflated costs of living. That's an interesting thing that they fought long and hard to resist. I mean, they've spent decades trying to destroy the notion of the traveling community and to force people into homes. The long running battle between, you know, settled establishment community and nomadic people, that they hate them, that they want to stop them traveling freely and they want to put them into houses. Well, they've tried to put people into houses, and then the houses have turned out to be completely unaffordable. So they've now created a problem which is manifesting itself in the most interesting ways, I think, about how people are having to be tolerated living in ways that are not supposed to be societally acceptable, living in caravans, living in you know, all kinds of ways that are not what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to be in these little homes and not complain about anything. It becomes affordable, and suddenly the whole thing starts breaking down. So it's interesting from that point of view.
It is. And the other thing, of course, is there's less of a matter of choice in this. Many of the people who were on the peace convoy were living in a 1970s, early 80s world where actually it was pretty easy to get yourself accommodation. In fact, local authorities were just housing people if they were homeless. Now it's completely the opposite. It's almost like it's turned on its head, Andy.
Yeah, absolutely it has. Yeah, it's completely impossible for people, Tony. It's you know, and it's multiple failures repeated by multiple governments, and it goes on and on and on, and nobody wants to deal with it. But on every front, you're right. It was a golden age compared to now being young and not even having much money back in the 70s and the 80s. The possibilities of what you could do, taking to the road, living in squats, signing on easily in a system where, you know, capitalism is a system that deliberately doesn't intend to provide full employment to everybody. Full employment for everybody is a socialist ideal. So you have entrenched systems that are designed to make people unemployed, and then you punish them for being unemployed. You know, every aspect of it has come together to create this horror story. And, you know, in a way, it's a wonder that everybody is so quiescent, really. We're living in a world now where, you know, from every moment, from when we started recording this show to now, the billionaires are considerably richer while the poor people are getting poorer by the minute.
Yeah, so this is a political aspect of what's happened. You're absolutely right. The key thing to understand is that there is no right anymore for people without money to get together and organise.
Yeah, that's right, on every front, yeah.
So, Andy, how do people get hold of your book? What's it called, and how do they find you and follow you?
Well, the best way is to go to my website, which is andyworthington.co.uk. I also just recently set up on Substack. So if people subscribe on Substack, then they will get notifications about everything that I do in their inbox. That's andyworthington.substack.com. And if people go to my website, that's where they can find copies of The Battle of the Beanfield and copies of Stonehenge Celebration and Subversion, which are both still in print and both available to buy from me.
So there are also some other books around, aren't there? The Peace Convoy Days, particularly the photos. Any recommended books if people are interested?
I don't know what's in print and what isn't anymore at the moment, actually.
Well, yeah, but you can get the old secondhand stuff pretty easily online now.
I mean, there is quite a lot out there, that's for sure. And I would also like to say that the 1991 documentary about the Beanfield, which coincided with the trial that was taking place that I spoke about earlier, the co-director of that, my friend Neil Goodwin, has, with the help of Dale Vince, digitized the archive. He's made a new 1-hour edit of the original documentary, and he set up a website where he's also made available the full-length interviews with many of the key people at the time, excerpts of which were used in the documentary. So that's thebeanfield.co.uk, and I very much recommend people to go and check that out.
Well, for any non-digitals, there is also a book called Medieval Brigands, which I think is not that easy to get hold of, but it's got some fantastic photos. It's actually quite inspirational, I think, for many of the people living in vehicles now, because there's the potential to do all sorts of other things. Anyway, you mentioned briefly, didn't you, Dale Vince's role? You mentioned him again. He's now running Ecotricity, but what did he do on the day of the Beanfield, Andy?
He was the motorbike outrider, so he was the one who went ahead of the convoy to check out what was happening, and he's the one who came back to the head of the convoy after he saw the roadblock. There's an interview with Dale that took place recently as part of this, re-edit of the documentary and making available the interviews. And it's very interesting because he's noticeably emotionally still moved by what happened on that day. And I found that very interesting because most of the recordings for the documentary were undertaken in 1991. And it was the first example I'd seen of somebody talking about it now, and seeing that no one really recovered from the damage of what happened on that day. I mean, emotionally, it has lived on with everybody, and that's an important point to recognize. And it's important to have that to be able to perceive that emotional response to the cruelty of what happened on the day.